Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Senator McCain urging his colleagues to vote against the confirmation of Gina Haspel to head up the CIA because of her equivocation over renouncing torture as immoral, and speak with a former member of the CIA's clandestine service who tried to stop the torture program from within the agency while Dick Cheney was ordering them to double down on a practice that was both immoral and ineffective. Glenn Carl, who retired from the CIA in 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats and is the author of The Interrogator, An Education, joins us from Tokyo. We will discuss the local reaction to the summit between Trump and Kim Jong-un, now scheduled for June the 12th in Singapore, and whether McCain's thumb down on Haspel could sway other Republican senators and wavering Democrats to reject her nomination to head up the CIA, as well as the failure of senators to question Haspel during the public confirmation hearings on the fact that, in spite of Trump's claim to the contrary, the CIA has found no evidence that Iran has cheated on its commitments to the JCPO deal, which Trump just pulled the U.S. out of. Then we will speak with Thomas Wright, a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy, as well as a fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. The author of All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power, he joins us to discuss his article at Politico, John Bolton and Mike Pompeo Are Headed for a Clash, and how the pragmatic and ambitious Pompeo has his eyes on the presidency, while the ideological Bolton, who has no sense of strategy beyond nationalism and hatred of multilateralism. Then finally, we'll get an insightful briefing on the tenuous state of American democracy as we find ourselves caught between two kleptocratic and autocratic criminals. One, Vladimir Putin, has used fascist tactics to neutralize democracy in Russia and justify rule by wealthy oligarchs, and the other is a wannabe billionaire whose business was rescued by Russian dirty money, Donald Trump, who owes his election to the Russian intelligence services and is attacking the very foundation of American democracy, the rule of law, as the special counsel Robert Mueller closes in on him. Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale and author of On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, joins us to discuss his latest book, Just Out, The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America. And joining us now is Glenn Carl, who is the author of The Interrogator and Education. Glenn Carl was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. He joins us from Tokyo. Welcome to Background Briefing, Glenn Carl.
Nice to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Glenn. And do you mind just, I wanted to talk a little bit about the local reaction in Japan to the announcement that the summit will take place between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump on June the 12th in Singapore. The reason apparently it's in Singapore is that that's as far as the jet that Kim Jong-un has will fly. He wanted it in Pyongyang, and they decided on a neutral place, Singapore. So it's pretty extraordinary to think that the country that has these nuclear weapons is so decrepit it doesn't even have a plane that can cross the oceans. But in any case, the Japanese clearly are unsettled by this. Abe clearly is as well. He's come to Washington, or at least to Mar-a-Lago, and gone back empty-handed, as have Macron and Merkel and the British foreign minister. So what are you hearing?
Well, I wish I had some firsthand insights, but I literally arrived after midnight last night, and I have not had time to get out of my hotel room yet since the morning has come. So my firsthand insights will come a little too late for our interview, but I do interact with the folks I'm going to be seeing here, a number of correspondents and foreign policy experts. And you summarized well the apprehensions. Japan is almost as interested or affected as anyone with the North-South and now Trump's issues on the nuclear programs of North Korea, and is more on the margins in the diplomacy than anyone. This has been so far a tripartite series of maneuvers more than anything, North, South Korea, and the United States. And even China seems to have scrambled a bit to remind the North Koreans that China is the most important player for them long term. So there's anxiety and a perception, I think, of being progressively marginalized. Myself in one of my columns have written that the Japanese have learned, although they knew it anyway, I think, that the United States of Donald Trump will do what it feels like doing, and Japan will benefit or be harmed, but is everyone else is largely irrelevant. So anxiety and a concern that things are slipping away, with skepticism, I think, that everyone has about whether there will be true denuclearization. We'll see. We're dealing with a capricious person in the White House.
Well, is there a sense, though, that because Donald Trump is basically a reality TV star and just wants to look good, that he's already claiming he's going to get the Nobel Prize? Do you think he just will sign anything that makes him look good, and therefore that gives Kim Jong-un leverage?
Oh, I think so. I've been on record for a while that the one leading the dance for the last couple months has been Kim Jong-un. He has established himself. He's diffused some tensions. He has improved relations with the South. He's made it more likely that sanctions will ease, that will help him. He's diminished the likelihood, I would say, of a unilateral action, or made it harder for the United States. And he's, and I think most importantly or substantively for him so far, he's effectively had himself now treated as a peer state and peer leader by China, by South Korea, and by the United States. All of those things are a success. The United States has achieved three American citizens are out. That's nice. Yeah, I don't mean to belittle that. That's a good thing, but okay. And beyond that, I don't know. So I think that Trump, yes, will declare victory, whatever the and historic triumph. The title of my most recent article was "The Greatest Diplomatic Triumph in American History." I hope, using irony, that people will appreciate. And what actually will come of it, I think, will be a series of small, inspection agreements and a freeze, which would be useful, but not an elimination.
Sure,
but Trump will declare his victory. Yeah,
of course. But if he actually does something, then he should get the praise that is due to him, and he should get his Nobel Peace Prize. But we're all right to be skeptical. And again, I'm speaking with Glenn Carl, who's the author of The Interrogator and Education. He was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. And he joins us from Tokyo. So today, or yesterday, after the hearings of the public part of the hearings of Gina Haspel, John McCain made a statement suggesting that he simply couldn't vote for her because he didn't feel her questions on answering the questions about the morality of torture, which she equivocated on, he thought that was a disqualifier. And already we're learning from the White House in their communications meetings how to deal with McCain and get the Haspel nomination through. One of the White House aides said, well, McCain doesn't matter, he's dying anyway. So that's the attitude in the White House. But do you think McCain's going to sway any other senators?
I'm afraid that he won't. One of the horrifying aspects of the last couple of years has been the abject kowtowing and surrendering of principle of the Republican Party and leadership to Donald Trump, believing that it's more important to achieve tax cuts and the withering of the federal state than to uphold American democracy and the separation of powers in our government. So I don't think that McCain's statement probably will make a difference. I'm afraid not. I've gone further than Senator McCain. This is an issue that he and I agree on. We disagree on many things, but simply her statement that equivocating on the morality of torture is, yes, disqualifying. But beyond that, independent of Gina's merits or character or experience, all of which are fine. She's, I don't know her well, I only know her slightly. But by all accounts, she's a decent person, a solid officer, if not spectacular. She, nonetheless, on a critical issue, embodies, whatever her personal feelings, embodies torture by the United States government. So to put someone like that in a position of authority essentially authenticates this policy for the United States, even if we don't do it now. It makes us less of a democracy and less of a country with the rule of law. And so it's a disqualifying act. It should be straightforward. And it's a sad thing, perhaps, for Gina Haspel, but that should be clear. There are larger things than one's personal character, and simply to be tarred and associated with this should be disqualifying. So I even go further than Senator McCain.
Well, you, I recall, were basically, when you're in the CIA, you were told to go to a black site and interrogate somebody who was like number three in Al Qaeda or something, and you know, and it turned out to be a complete nobody. But you asked for the presidential finding, which is the legal underpinning of the activity that you were ordered to do. And didn't they just hand you John Yoo's opinion? I mean, they didn't even have a proper finding.
Well, there never was a finding, and that exchange is I did have that exchange. It was one of the first comments I made within the first minute of being briefed. I said, to do something like that, we would need at least a presidential finding. And I was told, yeah, we're covered, we have it. Or actually, the order of the expression was, we have it, we're covered. And then I didn't see it at that instant. It was not too long afterwards that I read what was a presidential memorandum, not a finding. There never was a finding. At the time, I was unclear on what difference there might be between something from the president directly or a finding. But my reaction, nonetheless, was the same, and it truly was. I said, I don't care if the president orders this. He doesn't get to do that. It's just illegal. It's straightforward. I don't know. There really isn't any debate or hesitation to have on this. And if one knows anything about the last 2,000 years of Western struggles to advance individual rights and the rule of law, it was straightforward. I will say one thing. I do want to correct something. I try to speak the truth here, and you overstated, I'm afraid, for me, the role I played. I did oppose torture, and I have. I am proud of everything I've done since then. I think I acted honorably while in there, but I didn't lead a campaign in the hallways directly against the chain of command and the White House to stop torture. I tried to act honorably and not do it myself, and then to convince others not that we shouldn't.
I should have said that you tried to stop the program that you ordered, where you quickly found that this guy that they said was like number three was a nobody, and this was ridiculous. Yes, and every time you called up headquarters and said, this guy doesn't know anything, they said, oh, you've got it. He's a clever Al-Qaeda-trained dissembler. He's just tricking you, and therefore you've got to enhance the interrogation. That's my understanding.
Oh, that's absolutely right. It was truly Kafkaesque and surreal, because I was told, I'm not making this up, and I'm not paraphrasing, the absence of an answer is proof of guilt, to which I started to laugh. I mean, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. And then I was told that if not to do this was to be was being complicit with our enemies and to lack patriotism. So that's all true. It was just absolutely obscene what was happening. And the one good thing that I found, the one surprise from the Senate investigation, the Senate report on torture, was that I thought that I was alone in all of that. And actually, many of my colleagues shared my misgivings, but we were all isolated and unsuccessful in getting anyone to act upon our reservations, our concerns, and our opposition.
Well, you've made it clear that you think Haspel's a bad choice. The other person that Trump wanted or was floating, and certainly he himself has been lobbying hard for the job, is Senator Tom Cotton. So we could be out of the frying pan into the fire, right?
Yeah, well, American democracy, in your lead-in just before our segment began, you you're going to have Professor Snyder on, I think, talking about the fragility of our democracy. And here, too, I wish that I got fundamental things wrong and minor things right or something. You know, one reason I wrote my book now almost a decade ago, 8 years ago, whatever, 7 years ago, was because I viewed quite clearly the enhanced interrogation torture program, what we did, how we covered it up, how we justified it, and how so many people quickly bought into it, professionals and general public. I viewed all of that as a precursor sign to the erosion of our democracy. It sounds crazy. It did sound crazy to many people that I say such a thing. I hope it doesn't sound so crazy now, because our democracy always has been fragile. Democracy is. And we are probably not a democracy by many standards of measurement at this point. It's just shocking. If you don't have the rule of law and your laws are flouted, then an election is sort of a Potemkin exercise. And truly, we are sliding that way. It sounds extremist, but I'm not a partisan on this. It's horrible events we're living.
Well, Glenn Carl, I thank you very much for joining us.
Anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Glenn Carl, who is the author of The Interrogator and Education. He was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in 2007, a deputy national intelligence officer for transnational threats. And he joined us from Tokyo. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with Thomas Wright to discuss his article at Politico. John Bolton and Mike Pompeo are headed for a clash.
Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Thomas Wright, a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy, as well as a fellow in the Center for the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. His latest book is All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power. And he has an op-ed at Politico. John Bolton and Mike Pompeo are headed for a clash. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Wright.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, thank you, Thomas. And since you're a fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe, it does seem that Donald Trump has treated the European allies in the similar way to which he treated Mitt Romney, the Republican candidate for president running against Obama, who he humiliated by dangling in front of him the Secretary of State's job, meeting with him for dinner on a couple of occasions, and then not giving him the job. And the same pattern seems to be taking place here, where European leaders like Merkel, Macron, and the Foreign Secretary of the UK come over here begging him not to pull out of the JCPOA Iran deal. And he appears to entertain them, dangle the possibility that he would listen to reason, and then at the last minute pull the rug out from under them. So is there a pattern there?
I've never thought of that analogy, but I think there's a lot to it, actually. You're right that he basically dangled in front of the Europeans the possibility that they could save the deal. European governments, particularly the French government, invested a lot in trying to get close to President Trump, in trying to build close ties to him in the hope that they could influence him. But what he declared this week in the Iran deal, I think, was beyond or at the very least at worst case scenarios that that they had contemplated, in that he left really no wriggle room for negotiating on the deal. He didn't really pull his punches in terms of the sanctions He indicated they were going to go full throttle on a campaign of maximum pressure against Iran. And so this, I think, really is the worst-case outcome for President Macron and for all of the EU leaders on Iran. And they now need to figure out how to proceed from here. But there's no doubt that they basically got nothing from the Trump administration on this decision.
And just turning to your article, Politico, John Bolton and Mike Pompeo are heading for a clash. They do seem to have almost polar opposite worldviews. And since we are in a country where a lot of powerful plutocrats tend to have a lot of sway because we have a money-driven electoral system, and the two biggest donors, if you will, to the Republicans and to the White House, Adelson, the casino magnate to the Republicans, and particularly his protege is John Bolton. He urged the White House to take him on. Pompeo, of course, the Secretary of State, former Director of Central Intelligence, he's mentors and people who've funded his political career in the past are the Koch brothers. So you have, if our politics are run by the donors, which I think you can make a case is pretty much the case, since our politicians basically spend most of their days dialing for dollars like telemarketers, is it possible that that is a way to look at how different these are? You've got a kind of libertarian on the one side and a neocon on the other?
Well, I look in the piece, I didn't really get into that, but I did look at sort of their main motivations and ambitions and backgrounds, which I think are different, not sort of in the way people often identify in terms of one school or another school of thought, but in terms of what really drives them. So for John Bolton, he spent his entire career basically fighting in multilateral institutions and in debates about international law against multilateralists and against progressives and other governments that try to see institutions and laws as a constraint on American power. And so his entire outlook is really defined by those legal battles and legal arguments. And now he finds himself in a position that he's always coveted to try to accomplish what he always wanted to achieve, which is to demonstrate that the U.S. is free from all of these constraints. And he really, whenever he writes about Iran or North Korea or issues like that, he focuses almost entirely on his legal theory and why the U.S. has freedom of action, but never really on the foreign policy or strategic issues or, you know, American interests. Pompeo is very different. He's a politician. You know, he was elected for the first time only in 2010 in Kansas, and he's had a rapid ascent. And he's 54 years old. He's considerably younger than Bolton. And he sees himself, I think, as having a bright political future, including possibly running for president. And so I think he needs his job to be seen as a success in 4-8 years' time. He can't afford for it to be a failure. He needs to plan for the future in maybe a way that Bolton is not. And so in the article, I sort of talk about this difference between litigators and planners. The litigators are those like Bolton and Trump who want to go after their enemies today and tomorrow and then close the file and move on to the next thing and not really plan for the future. The planners are the ones who say, okay, after the score settling, then what? What do we do in Iran? What happens in Korea? You know, what's the plan? What's the strategy? And I think that's sort of the difference. Certainly between Bolton and Mattis. And the big question, I think, is where Pompeo comes down. And I think he actually probably will have strong incentives to align with Mattis rather than with Bolton.
Well, there does appear to be, in terms of the global theater, a division of labor here. Arguably, Bolton is getting his way in the Middle East with the end of diplomacy and a march to war in both the Middle East and the Gulf. And on the other side, you've got Pompeo, the peacemaker, having set up this summit that's coming up now on June the 12th in Singapore. Singapore, I think, is chosen because that's the extent of the range of the jet that Kim Jong-un has can't fly any further than that. And of course, that raises the amazing thing, this decrepit country that can't feed its own people, yet has all these nuclear weapons. It's a strange situation that the tyranny of the weak is now meeting with the most powerful nation on the earth, and almost on an equal level, if you will. I think Kim wanted it in the summit in Pyongyang, of course. Most pundits and analysts seem to think this is going to be a victory for Trump. He's already talking about Nobel Prizes. Is it possible, though, that because Trump so desperately wants a win and a public relations win, which I think is largely his outlook on life and his presidency, does that mean that Kim has a lot of leverage in the sense that Trump wants a deal so bad he might sign anything?
Yeah, I think there is a real risk that this summit ends up with Trump giving away far too much and gets far too little in return. You know, there's two dangers, I think, with the summit. One is that it fails, they don't get on, and then Trump says, okay, I tried diplomacy, now we're going to go to war or use force or regime change or something like that. So that's sort of one risk. But the second risk, which is, I think, as real, is that he goes in and goes wildly off script and basically agrees to take out all of the troops out of Korea in exchange for sort of vague promises on the ICBM program, so on the ballistic missiles that can hit the United States, the intercontinental ballistic missiles. And that, you know, it's a deal that any other president would be pilloried for, but that he may well do because he's never really liked the fact that there are troops in Korea in the first place. And that, of course, will be hugely destabilizing for the region, for U.S. allies. There will be a question about whether or not the deal will be sustainable at home, whether or not it would unravel after the fact. So that is a risk, and he has raised expectations so high now that I think he'll be incentivized to try to go for the big win. He's not necessarily going to go for the vague statement that launches a year or a year and a half of very difficult technical talks, after which there's a technical incremental agreement that's flawed. It's big drama. The big drama is what he wants. But I think there's a lot of very nervous people, particularly in Japan and in South Korea, about how this might go.
So turning to your article, Thomas Wright, John Bolton and Mike Pompeo are headed for a clash. It does seem that Pompeo is a very ambitious and arguably a very clever politician. I learned for the first time from your article that Pompeo had reached out to both Hillary Clinton and John Kerry in help to get Democrats to support him in the confirmation vote for Secretary of State. As you know, he barely made it. And now, of course, we have a similar situation with Gina Haspel at the CIA. She's apparently close to Pompeo. He recommended her for the job and not Tom Cotton. And I take it the assumption is that Pompeo doesn't want Tom Cotton competing with him because Cotton is also a favorite of the president's. So is that what's going on here in terms of personal ambition?
Yes. Well, I think Pompeo, I think, has remarkably maneuvered himself into the position of Secretary of State. I mean, that was quite an accomplishment. You know, he was a member of the House Intelligence Committee, but managed to leapfrog the chairman of that committee, Mike Rogers, to be tapped as CIA director. And then he was only a year in that job before maneuvering himself into Secretary of State. So it is quite an astonishing rise. It's unclear, I think, exactly why he backed Gina Haspel for director of the CIA. But certainly one theory out there is that he saw Cotton potentially as a rival. Another is that Cotton may have decided late on that he didn't want the job, although he let it be known sort of early on that he did want it. So I think that still remains a little bit unclear. But there's no doubt, I think, that that Pompeo sort of sees himself as a potential successor to Trump or somebody who could run for president in the future. And the big question is whether or not that will sort of change his outlook, because he, I think, for his own political interests, will need a more long-term perspective than somebody like John Bolton, who I think sees this as his last best chance really to accomplish his agenda. The other piece of it as well is that, of course, Bolton has very antagonistic relations with the State Department. He sort of made a career of complaining about State Department bureaucrats, and so he's appointed people in the NSC who will try to enforce his will on the other departments, on the Pentagon and on State. And that, of course, will bring him into a clash with Pompeo and with Mattis, both of whom will not want the NSC to be dictating their personnel choices. So I think across the board, we're sort of seeing the beginnings of a new division within the administration.
Well, just in closing, is the fundamental difference that between Pompeo and Bolton is that Bolton is an ideologue? He really believes in the neocon plan, which, of course, after Iraq, you'd wonder why anybody would take any of these people seriously. And now, of course, they're doing the same thing with Iran. They're putting up the MEC, this disgusting group, in the way that they put up Chalabi as a kind of Nelson Mandela in post-Saddam Hussein Iraq. Well, we know how that worked out. So they do seem to be driven by ideology more than anything else, or, you know, I guess some sort of exuberant utopianism, I suppose. But on the other side, it seems like Pompeo is a pretty cold, calculating, deeply ambitious person who's much more into realpolitik and positioning himself. You know, he's a right-wing rabid hawk on Benghazi, and the next minute he's making nice with Hillary Clinton to help get the job as Secretary of State. So is that the fundamental difference?
Yeah, I think basically, I mean, I don't think Bolton is necessarily a neocon because he doesn't really care about democracy promotion. He's more of a nationalist like Dick Cheney, probably with a very sort of narrow perspective on America's role in the world, but quite assertive and aggressive in his own way. So I think that he will be much more skeptical of values, human rights, democracy as a part of U.S. foreign policy than most neoconservatives would be. But I think within that he's very ideological, and I think his main ideology is this opposition to international law and international institutions. So that's really what drives him, and I try to track that in the article, looking at his history on that issue in particular. I think that comes out of his legal background, and he's really a lawyer. He's not a strategist. You know, he's not a foreign policy person. He sees this entirely, I think, through the perspective of international law, that international law is a threat to the U.S. that he needs to resist. And he sort of doesn't really pay huge amount of attention to broader geopolitical issues. Pompeo, I think, is a hardliner, but I think you're exactly right that he is sort of pragmatic. It's interesting when you talk to European diplomats on Iran, they find Bolton pretty much impossible and not willing to compromise. I'm not really willing to listen, but they find that Pompeo, even though they disagree with him, is a good listener. He's someone who takes into account their perspective, and they find him able to sort of constructively engage. And so he tends to have this reputation as sort of an effective actor who gains the respect of people who disagree with him, which I think is an interesting sort of political skill and distinguishes him in a way from Bolton, and also I think sort of affects his behavior as Secretary of State or previously as CIA Director.
Well, Thomas Wright, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great, thank you.
And again, I speak with Thomas Wright, who's a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy, as well as a fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. His latest book is All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power. And he has an op-ed at Politico, John Bolton and Mike Pompeo are headed for a clash. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with an insightful briefing on the tenuous state of American democracy as we find ourselves caught between two kleptocratic and autocratic criminals. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Timothy Snyder, Professor of History at Yale. In 2010, he published Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, a history of Nazi and Soviet mass killing on the lands between Berlin and Moscow. It was named a Book of the Year by some dozen publications and was a bestseller in four countries. He's the author of On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, and his latest book just out is The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, and America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy Snyder.
Very glad to be with you.
And Timothy, it seems that we are trapped between two autocrats, Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. And the only way that we're going to be rescued from the trajectory we're on, which is a global trajectory where democracy's under assault and autocracy's on the rise, appears to be the Mueller inquiry, which the Republicans and the White House seem desperate to stall or stop. What's your sense of whether or not our fate hangs on the truth coming out via Robert Mueller?
No, it's a very fundamental question for all of the reasons that the premise of it suggests. First of all, I just want to emphasize a point that you make very briefly, which is that this is a global trend. For the last dozen years, according to Freedom House, authoritarianism has been on the rise and democracy has been receding. And of course, it's the youngest generation in the U.S. and also in Europe, which is least sympathetic to democracy and most sympathetic to authoritarianism. So there is a worrying trend here. And secondly, as you've also suggested, globalization has something to do with it. It's not that Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin are on different planets with no connection one to the other. In many ways, they're very similar creatures who are made possible by a kind of carelessness around the edges of our capitalism and a kind of skepticism about the law, which brings me to your question about Mueller. I mean, it seems to me that the Mueller inquiry stands for two very fundamental things at its heart. The first is factuality. Without factuality, we can't have a lot of things that we take for granted. We can't have democracy without factuality. The markets will cease to work without factuality. And we can't have the rule of law without factuality. And that's the second thing which the Mueller inquiry stands for. Are we a government of laws or are we a government of men? It's a very fundamental question. I think sometimes people don't see just how deep this goes. The Mueller inquiry is not about one man against another man. The Mueller inquiry is about whether law actually includes all American citizens, applies to all American citizens, or whether someone who fancies himself to be a strong man can escape law. That's what it's all about. And if it turns out that Mr. Trump can escape law, then the system itself will change pretty fundamentally and pretty quickly, which is why I think American citizens who care about the future of the republic, despite other disagreements they might have, should see the Mueller inquiry as something which we need to keep the structures that we have going.
Well, of course, the difference in a way between Russia under Putin and the U.S. under Trump is that Trump certainly appears to be acting like a guilty person. He's never tried to get out from under the accusations and the questions about the legitimacy of his presidency, which a normal person would do immediately. You know, the day after the election, he would want to clear the air. But he never has. So he's been acting like a guilty person, and he's been assaulting the people who are looking into him, both Mueller, the DOJ, and the FBI. So I suppose the fundamental difference here is that Putin, a member of the Russian or the Soviet secret police, has created a kleptocracy regulated by the Siloviki, his cronies from the intelligence world, many of whom have been turned into oligarchs. So they have basically unleashed the secret police on Russian freedom, whereas our secret police, if you will, the FBI, are the ones that we're sort of counting on to save us.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental difference that I think you're suggesting has to do with precisely the rule of law. In Russia, no one really pretends that there is the rule of law. Everyone understands that the agents of the state, the Siloviki, as you say, are acting on behalf of the oligarchical clan that happens to have won, which is the Putin clan. We're not there yet, of course, although there are some tendencies that are pulling us in that direction. And what Mr. Trump is performing is a kind of preparation for us to become more like Russia. He's trying to get everyone to believe that the rule of law is a joke. He's trying to get everyone to believe that the agencies that that enforce the law are just partial, right? That they're partial against him when really they should be partial for him. But what's consistent in Mr. Trump's remarks is the notion that any agency is not about some objective principle. It's always partial one way or the other. And if people buy that notion, then we end up not believing in law because we don't believe that law can be enforced. So that's kind of the long game that he's playing. Another difference between Russia and America, and it's one which is kind of humiliating for us, is that the Russians have a notion of what they're doing. Mr. Trump is just an instrument from their point of view. And that's very hard for Americans to grasp because, you know, we either ignore the rest of the world or we assume that the rest of the world is somehow following our lead. That's just not the case here. And what we have in the relationship between Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump is that Mr. Putin has a notion of what he's trying to do. He's applying methods which actually have to do with the history of the Russian secret police. That's called active measures. He's using new technologies to apply old tools of secret police work to us. That was the 2016 election. In all of that, Mr. Trump is not colluding because Mr. Trump is not an equal partner. Mr. Trump is basically an instrument. He's a bit of driftwood which is floating along on the stream, and the driftwood is vaguely aware that there are larger forces around it, but the driftwood is not actually what's causing anything to happen. And so at the end of the day, we have Trump who's kind of aspiring to be in a Russian situation. He's pushing us towards being in a Russian situation. He's himself a product of Russian policy, but he's by no means an equal. And that's the odd thing for us. And of course, one sees that if you see the way Mr. Putin discusses Mr. Trump, it's much less respectful than the way Mr. Trump discusses Mr. Putin.
Well, indeed, Putin described Trump using the word Yalki, which was mistranslated as meaning brilliant, but in fact, it means somebody who likes the limelight, who likes the bright lights, etc. So, but again, I'm speaking with Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale. In 2010, he published Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, a history of Nazi and Soviet mass killings on the lands between Berlin and Moscow. It was named a book of the year by some dozen publications and was a bestseller in four countries. He's the author of On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, and his latest book just out is The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America. So, we've had, of course, the Gilded Age at the end of the 19th century, and many argue that we're in a second Gilded Age now. So the trend in our historical cycles has been, of late, plutocracy replacing democracy. So the fact that this current situation with Trump has Russian fingerprints all over it, a member of the minority side of the House Intelligence Committee just mentioned that, you know, every inquiry that's going on now, you shake a tree and a Russian falls out of it. How do you sort of factor that into the trend of plutocracy replacing democracy and how much Putin has accelerated this trend? Because my question would be, why are the American plutocrats not recognizing how this interloper has basically infiltrated our country, if you will? Are they happy with the idea of America becoming an autocracy too?
Yeah. So first of all, starting where you start with patterns, I think there's a background pattern here, which is how globalization goes wrong. The first globalization in the late 19th and early 20th centuries also generated ideas that sound familiar to us, like that there are no alternatives to liberalism, or that history's come to an end and we can look forward to, you know, a peaceful, predictable horizon of nothing really ever changing. And that broke with the First World War and with the Great Depression and with Stalinism and with Hitler and with the Holocaust and the Second World War. We've had a similar experience. We declared 100 years after that, we declared history was over, there are no alternatives. And then now it emerges that there are alternatives and that we've been blind to them because we've been telling ourselves that there weren't any such thing. So our, you know, in a way, the funny thing is that there's a history of globalization which we decided that we would completely ignore because we decided that everything was new. And part of that, as you suggest quite rightly, is wealth accumulation. I mean, by no coincidence, wealth inequality in the U.S. is now pretty much exactly where it was in 1929. And you have the associated political consequences, like that it's hard for people to believe in social advancement, like that people are anxious because the present seems bad to them and doesn't seem to be able to change, and also that communication is very difficult. I mean, if somebody has $1 billion and somebody else has $100, those two people might be formally citizens of the same country, but it's very hard for them to communicate. If you've got $1 billion, the truth is not enough for you, and if you've got $100, the truth is too much. And that helps us to explain how Russia interfered in the U.S. in 2016, or how it continues to interfere. We're in a situation which is vulnerable in its own right, where people have justified doubts about the formal and the substantial integrity of American democracy. And what Russia does is that it plays on that. It uses the internet to exacerbate people's doubts, to push people towards a situation not of justified skepticism, but of total cynicism, to push people away from trying to make things better and towards an attitude of, well, nothing can really change because who knows really, and it's all a conspiracy. That's the way that Russia has worked and continues to work inside our system. And, you know, as to the American reaction to this, I mean, I think a lot of wealthy Americans were surprised by this combination of real Russian oligarchy plus a fake American oligarch, because of course Trump, as far as we know, doesn't actually have any money. He's part of a global oligarchical scheme, which, in an interesting way, locks out or pushes to the side anyway some American oligarchs. But fundamentally, I don't think the situation is too surprising, because one of the ways that, you know, globalization works is that billionaires around the world have much more in common with one another than they have with their fellow citizens. So very cynical Russian oligarchs have more in common with very cynical American oligarchs than either of them has in common with the Russian or the American people. So that the fact that this can kind of be sorted out, where, you know, the Russian oligarchs get to have their candidate be president, and you know, the American oligarchs get to disassemble the Environmental Protection Agency, that this is kind of sorting itself out along those lines is maybe not really so surprising, and that's kind of where we are. The weird thing about it, the surreal thing about it, is the way Mr. Trump serves as a kind of point of contact, you know, this fake American oligarch who's a total failure in the U.S. context, but gets promoted as an American oligarch by Russian oligarchs. That's the weird thing. That's the uncanny thing, which makes it all possible.
But fairly recently, Oxfam came out with a report that something like 85 families control most of the world's wealth, or at least over half of the world's wealth. And the only historical model I can think in those terms is that we are, in fact, the planet is going back to a kind of medieval model where you have a small aristocracy with all of the wealth, and then you have a vast roiling underclass. And then in the middle, you've got a sort of sliver of lawyers and accountants who are the wealth management class. If that is the trend, what is driving it?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting question. What I would ask would be, what can be done about it? If one looks back to, you know, the medieval or the early modern situation that you're describing, what was done about it was the creation of the state. You know, the thing that we now take for granted, that entity which claims a monopoly on legitimate violence, which has a standing army, and which is able to tax its whole population. It seems to me that there is a pretty profound lesson for us there. So much of political dialogue in the United States, or what passes for political dialogue in the United States, is simply hostility to the state. But if the state is not functional, then this kind of wealth inequality is inevitable. And, you know, what's worrisome about the coalition which is in charge in the United States right now is it's between people who want the state to be weak so they can offshore all their money, and people who have been convinced that the state can't do anything because it's not doing enough for them right now. And there's no way to fix that except to create a state which, A, does more for people in general, and B, is able to extend its authority so that it's not so easy to keep transactions and just huge amounts of wealth beyond its borders. The state simply has to be functional. If we give up on the state, if we drink the Kool-Aid of how government can't really do anything, I think it's clear that these tendencies are going to accelerate with predictable political consequences. I mean, the more that people think that the state can't do anything for them, the more frustrated and angry they're going to get, and there's not going to be any way for those emotions to be channeled into action without the state. Meanwhile, the people who actually have the resources are going to be more and more scornful of the state and more open about their scorn for the state, and the kinds of alliances like the one that brought Mr. Trump to power will become more and more common. And so people will become more nationalist, and meanwhile, the state will be ever less able to do things for people. It's not a pretty picture. So, I mean, I have a very boring, straightforward thing to say about this, which is that we need to have some kind of broader consensus in the middle of the political spectrum about the state and about the rule of law. And the people who win elections in the United States have to be thinking not just about winning elections, but about how to extend the authority of the state into certain financial spheres where it's not currently present. You know, we need to have a situation where banks can't do business with anonymous clients. We need to have a situation where less wealth is offshored. We need to have a situation where you can't register companies anonymously, because those are the things which not only directly increase wealth inequality, because they create two classes of citizens, you know, the ones who have to pay taxes and the ones that don't. They also make possible the kinds of political deals which lead to outcomes like the election of Mr. Trump. The whole spectacle of Trump takes place in that half-legal, very murky world of offshore capitalism.
Well, indeed. That, of course, explains the assault on Obamacare. They have to kill off Obamacare so that the American people don't recognize that government services actually work. I mean, social democracy works on the simple premise that you pay your taxes and in exchange they become good stewards of your money and provide you with government services. And I guess the only lasting achievement of our social democracy that arguably existed from 1944 to about 1977 is Social Security, which is also under assault. So is that what's driving the Paul Ryans of this world? They have to prove to the American people that these things don't work, or have to sabotage them to the point where they don't work?
Yes. I mean, I'm afraid that's true. That's the fundamental conversation in American politics. Can the government do something for you or can't it? And the way that Republicans win is by persuading enough people who really need government that they don't need government. That's the way it works. And you use race to make that argument. You know, you tell white people, well, of course people like us don't need the government. It's only those other people who need the government. You play to pride. And you play to a sense of individual hardiness, and you play to virtues. You play to people's sense that they really should be able to do it on their own, and that's how you twist race and class together to undo the welfare state. And then when you undo the welfare state, you get consequences like life expectancy going down in the United States, which it has for the last 2 years, and almost certainly will for this year. I'd be surprised if it picks up, if it improves any time in the near future. Given that the opioid crisis is still getting worse, and given that suicides are still incredibly common, especially among American military veterans, so there is something deep going on here. But I'm afraid it actually goes a step deeper and darker, which is that it's not just that you're trying to prove that the state doesn't work. It's that you take the resulting anxiety, you take the resulting fear, and you turn it against other Americans or against other groups. I mean, people refer to Mr. Trump as a populist. I don't think that's true, because a populist actually does have some vague sense that he's going to use the government to help some people. Mr. Trump does half of populism. He does the rhetorical part. But he, in policy terms, he does the opposite. He makes people's lives much, much harder by doing away with parts of Obamacare, doing away with consumer protections, by not doing anything about opioids. And I think that's deliberate. I mean, I think the point is to change the conversation about government from one where the question is what can government do for all of us, to a question to rather government becoming a kind of public relations mechanism where, of course, we all take for granted it's not really doing anything, but it tells us who we're supposed to hate and fear and blame. So government helps to generate, you know, you disassemble the welfare state, you generate anxiety and fear and negative emotion, and then you direct it, right, which is what Mr. Trump is good at. He's good at blaming people for the dysfunctionality that he himself emits.
Well, today we just learned that the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, a billionaire Christian fundamentalist is in charge of education, has now rolled back reforms in terms of how students are being exploited in this country by these student loans, which are onerous. And it's destroying the economy because young people can't buy homes, refrigerators, cars, etc. They're indentured before they even get a job. It used to be, or it should be, that students are centers of investment, not centers of profit. But that is how our system has become so predatory. But just in the last minute here, I wanted to touch on something you brought up, and how the young, even though they, as I mentioned, the students are being, their horizons are being limited by this form of predatory capitalism, they are susceptible, probably in their anguish, to being manipulated. And of course, I think the most successful export from Putin to this country is what his political technologist Surkov managed to come up with, the idea of a managed democracy, and the extent to which, as a recent book suggests, nothing is true and everything is possible. Could you read this paragraph? Do you have the book, page 278?
You'll have to give me a second.
Because what really worries me is that I don't see how a country, particularly the world's lone superpower, can operate when there's no consensus on what is real and what is true. And Fox News already has about 40% of the country in a bubble of delusion, believing Trump and thinking everything else is fake news. And every time you see Kellyanne Conway and Sarah Sanders, you realize the encroachment into the very foundation of a functioning society, which is whether or not we can believe what is real and what is not. So would you mind reading that second paragraph on page 278? Because I think it really sums up the challenge we have today.
All of the virtues depend upon truth, and truth depends upon them all. Final truth in this world is unattainable, but its pursuit leads the individual away from unfreedom. The temptation to believe what feels right assails us at all times from all directions. Authoritarianism begins when we can no longer tell the difference between the true and the appealing. At the same time, the cynic who decides that there is no truth at all is the citizen who welcomes the tyrant. Total doubt about all authority is naivete about the particular authority that reads emotions and breeds cynicism. To seek the truth means finding a way between conformity and complacency towards individuality.
Well, Timothy Snyder, thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been my great pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Timothy Snyder, who's a professor of history at Yale. In 2010, he published Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, a history of Nazi and Soviet mass killing on the lands between Berlin and Moscow. It was named a book of the year by some dozen publications and was a bestseller in four countries. He's the author of On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. And his latest book just out is The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.